KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, where we discuss local, state, national, and international poorly segued stories. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there.
And first thing I'm going to mention is, do you know that we're coming up on an election? Do you know you only have until October 4th to be registered to vote? Not to sign up to register or to mail to register or to, you know, you've got to be registered by October 4th. And normally I've got like links and stuff you can go to. But as it happens, the Texas Tribune had a great story about the basics, how to find out if you're registered, how to apply to be registered, what kinds of stuff is going to be on the ballot. And I have a link to that story. So you can go to thinkwingradio.com, where I have links to all my stories. And it's always going to be the most recent one at the top, more or less at the top, depending on if another story catches my attention. And you can click on the link for the story, which is entitled, Texas has a constitutional amendments election this year. The last day to register to vote is October 4th. Statewide election, general election is November 2nd. 8 constitutional amendments, as well as various local and county.
Statewide offices. And
I don't think statewide.
Oh, really? Okay.
2022. But, you know, constitutional amendments in Texas are like birthday cakes for centenarians. We have so many constitutional amendments, you can cut them like a cake, but they all become law. And every new constitutional amendment for the Texas Constitution supersedes any law before it that contradicts it. And we're going to talk about the constitutional amendments briefly as we go down the show. But the main thing is, be registered to vote, absolutely registered by October 4th, the end of business, and vote. Okay, enough said, as Stan Lee used to say. Next story from communityimpact.com. Houston loosens taxicab regulations. And yes, we're going to talk about why I bothered to mention this story. Facing decreased revenues from a lack of conventions and large events, as well as competition from rideshare companies, the regulations for taxi cabs aim to lower operating costs for taxi cab companies by reducing the price of permits and ending a requirement for all cabs to have the same paint style. The city will also no longer limit the number of permits it distributes, city documents state. Previously, the city only distributed a limited number of permits at a time. Another provision incentivizes taxi cab companies to increase their supply of electric vehicles and handicap accessible vehicles by lowering the costs for those permits. The changes, approved by City Council September 15th, reflect a new approach to the city's relationship with taxicab operators. Prior to the pandemic, the City Council approved a plan to sell off all of its remaining permits and stop issuing permits entirely. At the time, council members in support of the previous plan cited competition from rideshare companies as motivation to divest from the taxicab industry and no longer use the permits as a revenue source for the city. Others expressed concern that it would stifle the industry's ability to grow in the face of increased rideshare competition. So this is important to me, it seems, on several different levels. First of all, taxi permits in New York City are extremely limited. And because the supply is so limited, and they're so in demand, they go for six figures, hundreds of thousands of dollars to buy a taxi medallion.
Is that good for one cab, or is that good for a company?
Well, it's like buying a house. It's kind of an appreciable investment.
Yeah, but does that one medallion, is that registered to one car, or is that registered to an entire company who may have a fleet?
I guess it depends. You know, okay. It might be some independent guy who was able to scratch up enough money to bid for and acquire a medallion, mm-hmm. or it might be someone who is able to get several, like Michael Cohen, Trump's lawyer. He actually had a group of medallioned cabs that he was using for revenue and other purposes. And then you've got like Yellow Cab that obviously has fleets and fleets of medallioned cabs. So it depends.
Okay.
But by limiting the supply is the point I'm getting, it becomes increasingly less affordable at the entry level. So that's number one. It becomes essentially a big guy's game. Number two, and this is not an original idea to me, I have to admit. I did some reading. And essentially, Lyft and Uber as corporations don't turn a profit.
Yeah.
Which makes them predatory, which basically means that their much lower rates, usually much lower rates for ride shares, are killing off taxi cab companies and taxi cab drivers, owners, at the same time that eventually when the competition is gone, being predatory, they will no doubt raise their rideshare prices. Now, also compare that to what they have done in terms of peak pricing, where sometimes in order to get home like 3 miles, you pay $80 because it's peak pricing. Other times, from what I've read, I've never used rideshare. I'm just an old school guy because I'm an old guy and I don't do rideshare. But I have read stories about rideshare operators. You know, they'll see the calls come in, they'll see one ride that's maybe half a mile and they're not going to get much money for that, and they'll respond and they're heading that way. But then all of a sudden they see a ride that's like for 5 miles and they'll just, never mind, I'm not going to that half mile ride, I'm going to the 5 mile ride. So you end up, and I've actually seen this in action, you end up not being able to get a rideshare, whereas a taxi would come. So I mean, there are all kinds of reasons why we need taxis. They need to be as affordable as possible while still permitting someone to make a living and make a profit. But they operate sort of in a different universe from rideshare. There was actually, and I know this is going on much longer than we intended, but we once had a receptionist at KPFT who, as a sideline, did rideshare. And one day as I was leaving the studio, I don't remember his name, but he was like a big guy. Maybe you've seen him. Maybe you'll recall. But one day I was walking out and he seemed agitated. And when I went to ask him if anything was wrong, apparently he was up against the deadline for his income taxes. Which I am too, by the way, October 15th. That's the deadline, just so you remember, guys, if you've been doing extensions. And one of the things he was struggling with was how to put in his rideshare stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've been a little bit down that road in terms of like depreciation and mileage versus cost of operation and that kind of stuff. So I was helping him through it. And at the end, what I realized, and what I don't know if he understood, but sort of, was that he hadn't made a profit. When you actually went through the cost of operation, the depreciation on the vehicle, the revenue, and the time he had actually spent, what he had done was work for cash flow. He actually hadn't made a profit in a conventional sense. He felt like he had made money because he was getting cash into his flow.
Right.
But he was wearing out his car. He was wearing out his tires. He was wearing out his brakes. He was wearing out his seats. All kinds of stuff that he was wearing out that ultimately is going to cost him. He was paying more for insurance. All this stuff. And, you know, he was getting murdered. So the company isn't making money. The rideshare drivers, for the most part, don't make much money, if any, when they actually figure it out. But they're killing taxi cabs. So that kind of brings me back to why I thought this story was worth mentioning. A very long story for a relative short story. Okay. Anything for you?
Yes. I mean, I like the EV and accessibility incentives in these new regulations, but I'm not sure about the new paint regulations, because I like being able to identify taxis as a glance, both as a pedestrian and as a driver, by their yellow paint. And I the new regulations might change that. It's not exactly made clear in the article.
The new regulations, in order to save costs, won't force, as I understand it, force taxi owners or drivers to pay for painting their cabs in a distinctive color. But if you've been to other cities, sometimes you have a variety of cab companies that are not yellow cab that have their own color schemes.
Mm.
In New York City, the term gypsy cab basically is what they used to do for rideshare before they had apps.
Mm.
You know, you had a guy that people in the neighborhood knew, especially in neighborhoods that taxi drivers wouldn't go to, and you called up the gypsy cab guy, and he'd come and give you a ride to the doctor, the grocery store, whatever. Mm. And certainly they didn't have standardized color schemes. So, it's, you know, I understand where you're coming from, certainly, but you get used to it. Also from communityimpact.com, Harris County commissioners propose tax cuts at cost of Harris Health System funding. Now, this is actually something that we touched on a couple of weeks ago. We have a 3-5 Democratic majority in the commissioner's court right now in Harris County, which means that where the Republicans used to be able to ram through stuff, now the Democrats can. But they have a quorum requirement, just like the Texas Senate. So you have to have at least 4 commissioners present to have a quorum. And the budget that the Harris, that the Democratic commissioners had proposed, and the tax rate that they had proposed to fund it, was more than the Republican commissioners wanted.
Mm.
So this is a follow-up on that story. On average, Harris County homeowners may see lower tax rates in the next year, but it will come at the cost of $17 million in funding for the county's hospital district, according to Harris County Administrator David Berry. At a September 21st public hearing, Harris County commissioners voted unanimously to propose a tax rate of 1.785 cents lower, so about 1.8 cents lower per $100 for the county's overall fiscal year 2020 to 21 than the Democratic County commissioners had proposed. This rate will provide less funding for the hospital district in the upcoming fiscal year than commissioners budgeted earlier this year, Berry said. According to Commissioner Rodney Ellis, you're deep in hell to be poor in terms of health care in Harris County. Although I know for homeowners, they will appreciate, you know, the tax reduction. Those people who rent, which unfortunately is far too many here, won't get this. For those who are homeless, we have to find the money elsewhere. They have tremendous unmet needs. While Republican Precinct 4 Commissioner Jack Cagle and Republican Precinct 3 Commissioner Tom Ramsey voted against the previously proposed tax rates at the September 14th Commissioner's Court meeting, the commissioners accepted the new proposal September 21st as a compromise. So, Cagle said, if you're a homeowner with a $100,000 home and last year you paid $599.20, with this proposal, you'll pay $581.35. Cagle said. Cutting the tax rates could impede the care that Harris County Health System provides for 300,000 county residents annually, Harris Health System President Dr. Esmail Porsa said. The system includes 2 full-service hospitals, 18 community health centers, and 5 school-based clinics, according to the hospital district's website. So, my comment here, Republicans Cagle and Ramsey threatened to screw the county budget to save $17.85 per year per $100,000 of valuation. So let's say if you have a $200,000 house, you're going to pay a whole $36 a year less. For that saving, they screw Harris County's poor and indigent out of essential medical care.
Mm.
Now, I do want to add from the article, not all who spoke at the September 21st public hearing were supportive of the higher tax rates. Houston resident Marissa Hansen said, quote, "It doesn't really make much sense to me why you want to raise our taxes. We're in the middle of inflation. Where are you getting the numbers that these hospitals need help when they're firing their own nurses and medical professionals because they refuse to take the COVID-19 vaccine?" Yeah. The late Marvin Zindler used to close many of his segments by saying it's hell to be poor. Mm. You know, it's a little bit like the discussion we had about prisoners. Doesn't matter whether they're fascist or communist or democratic or Republican or socialist. They all treat prisoners like crap. That's kind of how we treat the poor, too. Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, my question out of all this was, is this the same proposal that we talked about last week? Because didn't that say that home valuations would maintain the tax income despite the rate decrease? And if that's true, why is Harris Health funding being cut?
Okay, this is kind of a messaging clarity issue.
Mm.
So housing values are going up. There is serious property value inflation. So the tax rate, as I recall it, the tax rate the commissioners were proposing was a valuation, an appraisal, I guess would be a valuation cut.
Okay.
So the tax rate would go down, but because homes are being valued higher, your taxes would go up some.
Right.
And, you know, this is very, very common. Since real estate usually appreciates, property taxes usually reflect that in terms of the tax rate going down while the tax amount may go up. Mm. And in this particular case, in order to save a $200,000 homeowner $36 per year, we're not even talking per month, per year, you know, I imagine they spend half that amount on coffee every month, you know, bucks 50 a month, $3 a month. But, you know, people are tight-fisted when it ain't them.
Yeah. Mm.
You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. You can listen live online at kpft.org, podcast it, which is one of my strong suggestions. You can also visit archive.kpft.org and listen to past editions of this show, as well as many others of the 100-some shows that KPFT has online. Every story on the show is heavily excerpted, which is why you can find links to full articles on my blog at Think Wing Radio. Click on the show posts and more at the top of the page, find the post or the show date. You can also type keywords into the search bar. And we're on social media, where we can take questions, comments, and suggestions. Just check the show's Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig, and look for me on Twitter at Think Wing Radio. Plus, Andrew has his own accounts.
I sure do. You can find me on Twitter at DominateEYE, and spelled the same on Tumblr at DominateI.tumblr.com.
Okay, our next story from CommunityImpact.com, and I thought this was interesting given Texas's reputation for raising, and I mean that with a Z, anything that gets in the way of so-called progress. The city of Conroe is considering Texas Historical Commission certification. At a September 22nd workshop meeting, the Conroe City Council was introduced to the idea of becoming a certified local government through the Texas Historical Commission. According to the Texas Historical Commission's website, the Certified Local Government Program is a national initiative partnering local, state, and federal governments in an effort to preserve historic resources and communities. Once a local government has been certified, it can apply for grants, which the THC website said are often used as seed money to attract further funding. According to the THC website, the highest priority for grant funding is inventories and surveys. The website says that grants typically range from $2,000 to $30,000 and require a dollar-to-dollar match from local funding. The city council was receptive but did not make a determination. Council member Duke Kuhn suggested the council wait to hear the full presentation, which was not available at the September 22nd workshop. You know, living in Houston, having seen historic buildings go down, and I like the small town vibe. I've always liked the small town vibe. It's hurt me to see small towns die. Mm. Conroe is not a dying small town. It's somewhere between a living small town and a small city. Mm. And I would like to see that vibe preserved. And I'm glad that the Conroe City Council is looking into getting aid in order to make that a reality. Andrew?
Yeah. First off, to disappoint any listeners who just tuned in, THC does not mean anything related to cannabis. It is the Texas Historical Commission.
I tried so hard not to bring that up.
I know. I know. But yeah, I mean, I think this is a good thing. You know, like you said, you know, there are a lot of local governments out there who have a little bit of difficulty with cash flow, and historical preservation isn't necessarily high on the list of city services and expenditures. So these kinds of grant programs hopefully will help save some of those historically important locations that otherwise might fall through the cracks.
You know, it occurs to me that on Turner Classic Movies recently, they showed the movie The Last Picture Show.
Uh-huh.
And in this context, it is a movie where you watch a small town die. Huh. And it's a really, really sad thing. Mm. Okay, next story from CommunityImpact.com. 8 statewide propositions on Texans' November 2021 ballot and what they mean. Now, I'll point out I don't trust anything the Texas legislature does or proposes, so keep an open mind while discussion on these amendments develops over the next few weeks. Voters will find 8 propositions to amend the state constitution on the November 2nd ballot. Community Impact newspaper spoke with Brandon Rottinghouse, the University of Houston's political science chair, to break down each proposition. Proposition 1 has to do with rodeo raffles. It's asking, this proposition allows voters to decide whether charities for teams sanctioned by the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association or the Women's Professional Rodeo Association to hold charitable raffles. According to Rottinghouse, these races need to be approved through a constitutional amendment to avoid falling afoul of Texas's gambling laws. Just be suspicious of anything that the Texas legislature wants done, especially if they've decided suddenly gambling is good. Okay, Proposition 2 will determine whether counties can authorize bonds or notes to finance development in blighted or underserved areas. Rottinghouse described the amendment as a shortcut for county funding and said it could help urban counties going through a population boom. In principle, I like local control. But since we know that the Texas Republican government hates local control when it opposes what the state government wants, I would be suspicious. Proposition 3. This proposition will decide if state or local governments can limit religious services. Rottinghouse said this measure likely stems from COVID-19 mitigation efforts in 2020 when in-person religious services were limited in parts of Texas such as Harris and Fort Bend counties. Again, this is one that I would be particularly suspicious of, because it basically is saying what's more important, public health and keeping people alive or your right to go to church even if it kills your neighbors.
And that is the question, because
that is the question.
The proposition is, if you vote yes, or if the state population votes yes, the state will not be able to limit those things. And I think that's an important distinction to make here.
I'm actually going to provide another caution here. We don't know whether the right answer is yes or no, because wording is usually very, very tricky on this stuff. Sometimes no means yes, and sometimes that's yes true. Means no. We're going to have to, again, see how the debate on these amendments shakes out. So just mentioning. Okay, Proposition 4 would update requirements to serve on the Texas Supreme Court, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, the Texas Appeals Court, or as a district judge. According to Rottinghouse, it would require 10 years of service as a practicing lawyer or a combined 10 years of service in legal practice and as a judge of a state or county court. Having done a little more reading on this, this gets a little tricky. So I'm again, I would wait and see how the discussion, the public discussion on this shakes out. Proposition 5, voters can decide whether the Texas Commission on Judicial Conduct, which is responsible for disciplining sitting judges, can extend its powers to candidates for the office of a judge in Texas, allowing the commission to conduct investigations, accept complaints, and disqualify candidates not in office. And of course, the trick here is, would it be impartial or would it end up being used as a political weapon? So it might depend on how it's worded, or it might just be a bad idea at the outset. Again, wait for the wait for the public discussion to see how that shakes out. Proposition 6 asks voters to decide whether residents of facilities such as nursing homes have the right to determine an essential caregiver who can visit without restrictions. Rottinghouse says this proposition also stemmed from COVID-19 mitigation measures affecting some care facilities. So basically, if you're going to have home care, which I presume means that you probably have an impaired immune system for some reason or other, can you be certain that the person caring for you was vaccinated and won't infect you with a lethal disease?
I'm not sure that that's the question about this proposition.
It says
because it's
voters to
decide whether residents of facilities such as nursing homes. So it's not home care. You're in a nursing home. And further, it's talking about having essential caregivers who can visit without restrictions. So it's saying that, like, as I interpret this,
saying the word visit is what threw me.
Maybe. I mean, what it's saying to me is that a person in a nursing home, if this passes, which again, we don't know if that's how the pass fail would work. But if the law is enacted, would have the right to say, you know, my sister is an essential caregiver because she knows how to, you know, fix my medicine for me or whatever. And so there's no, like, healthcare restrictions on her coming to visit me in this nursing home. That's what I think this would do.
Again, now we're parsing a description of the language of the proposition, which just goes to show how tricky this stuff is. But to say that nursing homes have the right to determine an essential caregiver who can visit without restrictions, to me, says that the nursing home can decide whether it mandates having a vaccine, and the person being cared for, according to this, I don't see that they have any say or right to know, for that matter. But, you know, the devil is always in the details.
Yeah, we should do more research. But everyone should do more research.
It just goes to show, yeah, we're just going to have to wait and see how this sorts out in public discussion and do your research, and your vote matters, and this stuff can determine sometimes not only whether you have money or not, but whether you live or die. Okay, Proposition 7. This will determine whether surviving spouses of disabled people can receive limitations on the amount of property taxes they pay on their homesteads, provided they were age 55 or older when their partner died. Can you just see someone who is 54 and 11 months? It's going to happen. You know, it's always in the phrasing. Proposition 8 allows voters to decide whether surviving spouses of armed forces service members will be exempted from all or part of property taxes on homesteads, provided they were age 55 or older when their partner died. As a reference, I have a link on this show's webpage blog for Texas 2021 ballot measures, ballotpedia.org. You can go into the title of each proposition. You can go into, I think, the wording of each proposition. And again, I just want to point out, I don't trust anything the Texas legislature does or proposes. So keep an open mind while discussion on these amendments develops. Andrew?
Absolutely. Yeah, the link is on the blog post at thinkwingradio.com. Head to the show posts and more tab. And unless Mike posts something else in the meantime, it will be the most recent post at the top of the page.
And typically, I've been pretty good about posting the audio for these shows within about 48 hours, which is better than I used to do. So, you know, just get it. All right. Next, from the Texas Tribune. This should come as no surprise. Texas reduces Black and Hispanic majority congressional districts in the proposed map, despite people of color fueling population growth. The proposed congressional map also increases the number of districts where Trump would have had a majority of voters over Biden in 2020 and protects Republican incumbents who might have been vulnerable by packing their districts with more Trump voters. Republicans constructed the map with incumbent protection in mind, a strategy that focused on bolstering vulnerable GOP seats rather than aggressively adding new seats that could flip from blue to red. However, the map does, in fact, strengthen Republican positioning overall in Texas, going from 22 to 25 districts that would have voted for Trump in 2020. The number of congressional districts that voted for Joe Biden would have shrunk by one, from 14 to 13. You gotta love impartial redistricting. While many incumbents appear safe in these maps, others were drawn into districts that overlap with one another. For example, the proposed map pits House Republican Dan Crenshaw against Democratic Representative Sylvia Garcia. It also pits Democrat Al Green against Democrat Sheila Jackson Lee. Democrats who have been out of power for decades have attempted to make state elections more competitive, but the redrawing of congressional maps gives the GOP an opportunity to lock in their advantage for another decade. The redrawing of district maps is intended to reflect population growth captured by the latest census. Color accounted for 95% of the state's growth over the last decade, but in the new map, there's one less Hispanic majority district and zero districts with a Black majority. The latest census shows how Hispanic Texans nearly match the number of white Texans, and there is a graphic that I believe I'll be able to include in my blog post. Plus, of course, you can go to the article itself, which I strongly recommend. Said Domingo Garcia, national president of the League of United Latin American Citizens, this map is clearly gerrymandered by politicians to protect incumbents and totally discriminate against Hispanic voters. LULAC has filed suit against the state of Texas every 10 years since 1970, and we've prevailed every 10 years. Unless there's new maps drawn, we expect we'll wind up in federal court again. Gary Bledsoe, Texas president of the NAACP, called the proposal shocking, hurtful, and dangerous. The maps were proposed by Republican Houston State Senator Joan Huffman, who leads the chamber's redistricting committee. This is only the first draft of the map, which is likely to change before it's passed by the Texas legislature and signed into law by Greg Abbott. This will be the first round of political mapmaking in Texas since the U.S. Supreme Court struck down provisions to protect voters of color from discrimination. Previously, states with long histories of voting discrimination, like Texas, had to receive pre-approval from the federal government before making any changes to election laws or political maps. But the Supreme Court essentially did away with that requirement in 2013, leaving no buffer for voters of color if lawmakers passed discriminatory maps. Since the enactment of the Voting Rights Act in 1965, Texas has not made it through a single decade without a federal court admonishing it for violating federal protections for voters of color. Now, from my point of view, it's not just people of color who are disenfranchised by this gerrymandering. It's people of various political parties. If we're ever able to pass a comprehensive Voting Rights Act, it should cover both of these contingencies. I would also mention what I like to call the Tom DeLay precedent. I believe it was in like 2003 when Republicans took the Texas legislature for the first time in quite a while, and he went ahead and redistricted between censuses. So I think it was the 2000 census, favorable to Democrats or at least neutral. When Tom DeLay came in as the leader of the Texas Senate, I believe it was, he basically said, hey, there's no law that says we can't redistrict between censuses. So he entrenched Republican power, and that's the way it's been ever since. So, you know, if Democrats ever get the opportunity, there's no reason to wait until the 2030 census. Just go ahead and redistrict. You can make it fairer, but don't wait for 2030 because you never know. Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, as predicted last week, these maps aren't fair. Hopefully legal challenges will succeed against them, or the Fair Representation Act will make some headway in Congress to shake up districting. There's a link on the blog post at thinkwingradio.com for more information on that act.
Okay, next story from, you don't hear this one often, commondreams.org. I'm not necessarily saying that this is a source that I follow, but this happens to be correct information. Democrats' inept messaging. It's not a $3.5 trillion bill, but $350 billion a year. Democrats are misrepresenting the size of their own reconciliation package to their own detriment. The $3.5 trillion number sounds astronomical, is scary to many voters, and gives Republicans and conservative Democrats like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema a huge opening to attack the level of spending which the country allegedly can't afford without disastrous consequences. I will say, by the way, this is written in first person, so that's how I'm going to read it. To tell the truth, a number that large even scares me, a progressive Democrat who believes the fear of deficits is overblown. What's astounding, however, is that Democrats are misrepresenting the size of their own reconciliation package to their own detriment. Democrats are promoting it as a $3.5 trillion bill, which is endlessly repeated by the media, which makes it sound like Democrats want to spend $3.5 trillion in 1 year. Scary, but false. The Democratic bill is simply a blueprint for programs to be funded over 10 years. The actual cost of the bill is an average of $350 billion a year. It's a big number, but less than half of what the U.S. spends a year on the military budget, and mostly paid for by higher taxes on the wealthy and corporations. So the pay-fors are there. Andrew?
Well, it's a good point. Makes very good points. The question is, why are Democrats letting the narrative on this bill jump out of their hands?
Because that's what Democrats do, kind of like defund the police.
Well, I didn't want to say it, but
I mean, you know, that's, I know that you have a different idea of what that means, but well, in a sense, that's precisely the point. The messaging, does, if you have a message that requires explanation, you've lost the message.
Well, in somewhat, I guess, proving that point, I guess what I meant by I didn't want to say it was I didn't want to say that's what Democrats do, as in Democrats don't play politics well. But
yeah, well, yeah, that would be a sort of meta observation. Yeah. OK, from NPR.org, Janet Yellen says the U.S. could run out of cash to pay its bills in less than 3 weeks. Treasury Secretary Yellen warned lawmakers Tuesday that the federal government could run short of cash to pay its bills by October 18th, unless, which, by the way, isn't as far away as, you know, you might intuitively think it is. It's like 3 weeks, unless Congress acts quickly to increase the government's borrowing authority. The warning at an appearance before the Senate Banking Committee comes amid a standoff in Congress over the so-called debt ceiling. Senate Republicans blocked a measure to increase or suspend the debt ceiling on Monday, and it was a clean measure. It was just suspended, and Democrats only. They still filibustered. Yellen made it clear that failure to clinch a deal by mid-October would lead to the first default in U.S. history, an event she has described as catastrophic for the economy. Yellen cautioned that even flirting with a default could rattle financial markets. She recalled an earlier standoff during the Obama administration in 2011 when Congress waited until the last minute to raise the debt limit, resulting in higher borrowing costs for both the government and consumers. Essentially, just by playing this game, even if the U.S. government does not actually default, like maybe October 10th, they decide to pass a debt limit suspension or a debt limit increase. That could still reduce the United States credit rating, which happened the last time they did this. That was actually the first reduction in U.S. credit rating, at least in 100 or 150 years, if ever. And that resulted in higher interest rates on personal debt, on state debt, on corporate debt, on the national debt. It also made the world think that we were not as reliable as debtors, which means that, say, treasury bonds would cost us more money. I think right now the U.S. government pays something like 0.5% interest on bonds that we issue for our ongoing debt. It's sort of a rolling thing. And as those bonds expire, if our credit rating as a nation is diminished, we could see that go up a lot. So, you know, you're complaining now about a $1 trillion deficit. How does a $3 trillion deficit strike you after interest goes up, let's say, to 5% on our bonds, which, you know, in the past it's been because of inflation. So there's the debt. There's actual physical interest rates. There's the cost of closing the government and then having to reopen it after they do a debt limit increase. I mean, there's just no upside to this, and it's basically Republicans playing with the health and even survival of our nation. It really is just that serious. Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, I was exactly going to say that. Yet again, Republicans make life worse for everyone for the chance that they can trick their base and undecided voters into thinking a government financial crisis would be the Democrats' fault. There would be no crisis if Republicans had voted to raise the debt ceiling.
And it's worth noting that when they cut taxes under Trump, they didn't worry about pay for it. So they added $8 trillion to the national debt.
Yep.
You know, Republicans, the borrow and spend party. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. You can hear the show on kpft.org online, podcast it, my suggestion, or visiting the archive at archive.kpft.org for past versions of this show as well as other programming among the hundred-some shows that KPFT has online. KPFT is Houston's community station. That means we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied programming. You can go to the new kpft.org webpage and hit the donate button. Pick your favorite show, hopefully ours. Oh, my cat wants to get on my lap. And the amount of your donation, large, small, or in between, and you could get a lovely thank you gift. You can also donate by texting the word GIVE, G-I-V-E, to 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-5738. Or you can spread the word. That's free, and that helps, too. And by the way, all monetary donations are tax deductible. Okay, our next story has to do with why you need to be following varied news sources, because this is really interesting. This is a story that was reported in opinion pieces, actually, but three different ways from three different sources, and you'll kind of see what I mean. From the partisan perspective, an opinion piece written by Tom Cotton and Marionette Miller Meeks entitled Americans Wanted Biden to End the War, Not Lose It. The administration's, according to the subtitle, the administration's avalanche of incompetence has damaged our international reputation and humiliated the United States on the world stage. Tom Cotton is the senator Republican from Arkansas. Representative Marionette Miller Meeks is the Republican representative from Iowa. The piece goes on. The past month has been full of heartbreak, disappointment, and anger for thousands of veterans and Gold Star families. Through his actions, Our commander-in-chief has disrespected 20 years of selfless American sacrifice in Afghanistan and shown more interest in a photo op than in honorably completing the mission our service members gave so much to accomplish. We are now more vulnerable, according to this opinion piece, to a terrorist attack planned in Afghanistan than we were on September 11, 2001. Many in public life have been wrong about the war in Afghanistan, but few have been more consistently wrong than the president. Under the Obama administration, Joe Biden was wrong in opposing a counterinsurgency strategy to combat the Taliban, wrong about drawing down troops without a plan, and even wrong about killing Osama bin Laden. Joe Biden also stood by his boss when President Barack Obama, in exchange for an American traitor named Bowie Bergdahl, released five high-value Taliban commanders from Guantanamo Bay, four of whom now serve as senior officials in the Taliban government. And I mean, one of the things you have to notice here is that the 4 years of Trump never happened. Now, many of us wish the 4 years of Trump had never happened, but according to Tom Cotton and Marionette Miller Meeks, apparently nothing that Donald Trump did for 4 years made any difference, good or bad, because not mentioned at all. Just interesting. Now, the next story is what I would call the common media narrative from CNBC. Defense Secretary Austin admits in Senate testimony, Afghan army collapse took us all by surprise. The Pentagon acknowledged Tuesday that the stunning collapse of the Afghan army amid a rapid Taliban advance contributed to the Biden administration's chaotic exodus from the war-weary country. According to Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, speaking to the Senate Armed Services Committee, the fact that the Afghan army we and our partners trained simply melted away, in many cases without firing a shot, took us all by surprise. It would be dishonest to claim otherwise, said Austin, a veteran of the wars in the Middle East. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, U.S. Army General Mark Milley, said that while many of the Americans and NATO coalition-trained Afghan troops attempted to hold their positions against the Taliban, the majority did not. So I think that we can admit that we can agree that that's sort of the mainstream narrative as described there. Now, mind you, this is from one hearing. And then the next one is what I would call the right of center counterpoint. This is by Jennifer Rubin, who is sort of a lapsed Republican now. Her opinion piece is entitled Defense Officials Just Debunked Much of the Criticism of Biden's Afghanistan Withdrawal. Testimony from Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs Mark Milley before the Senate Armed Services Committee on Tuesday may not have persuaded those who wanted to continue an unwinnable war in Afghanistan, but they certainly put President Biden's decision making in context. The idea that the administration did not prepare for the collapse of the Afghan government was false. Both Milley and Austin described the advance planning in detail, including the pre-positioning of troops and rehearsing a non-combatant evacuation. The U.S. military could not secure both Bagram Airfield and Hamid Karzai International Airport with the troops available. Altogether, securing Bagram would have required approximately 5,000 to 6,000 additional troops, assuming no indigenous partner force was available. Austin also explained retaining Bagram would have contributed little to the mission that we had been assigned, to protect and defend our embassy some 30 miles away. That distance from Kabul also rendered Bagram of little value in the evacuation. Finally, the widespread declaration that the administration's airlift was a failure was exaggerated and lacked context. Austin and Milley conceded there were a couple of days of chaos, but tens of thousands more Afghans were evacuated than thought possible. Austin said, "We planned to evacuate between 70,000 and 80,000 people. They evacuated more than 124,000. Now, how the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan is, this is me speaking. How it's being framed seems more than usually variable, depending on who is doing the framing, which is why it pays as much as possible to mix your news sources. I mean, these three stories slash opinion pieces, you would almost think they're talking about three completely separate events, and yet they're all talking about the same event. And I had to put these three stories together because the range of variation was just astonishing to me. Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, from these three stories, it looks to me like the right, the center, and the center left are split as to whether the withdrawal was an unmitigated disaster or the best that could be done in the circumstances. To clarify, the right, center, and center left all have people saying both things. That's interesting to me. My perspective, as a single member of the far left, is that trying to judge the withdrawal alone is missing the point. The U.S. has spent decades destabilizing the Middle East, and now people are complaining when that destabilization catches up with us. We should have taken our hands off of the scales of power there long ago, or better yet, never gone in. Our policy of policing the world and acting like we were above consequences was never going to work, because international politics requires cooperation, not threat of punishment. That's my opinion.
And in a weird sort of way, that segues into the next story from DefenseNews.com. Could Britain stop Argentina from buying the JF-17 warplane? I just had to do this story because it's really fascinating. Argentina insists, reports the country is buying 12 JF-17 Thunder warplanes from Pakistan are premature, but analysts believe it could still succeed where other fighter types failed merely as a result of British pressure. Andre Serban-Pont, the director of an Argentinian think tank and a former advisor at the country's Strategic Affairs Secretariat, said he believes the JF-17 is an attractive choice for Argentina because the aircraft is, quote, out of reach of possible UK vetoing of parts, and at the same time, it is the only new aircraft within the budgetary restraints of the Argentine Air Force. The UK previously pressured suppliers to cancel deals with Argentina or sabotage them by embargoing critical British components. Britain has effectively maintained an arms embargo on Argentina since the 1982 Falklands War. However, the JF-17 can operate with solely Chinese subsystems, effectively making it immune from British pressure. Still, Serban-Pont said, the U.S. is making a push offering used F-16s, and another alternative being put on the table are modernized FA-18s. Brazil-based defense analyst Alex Galante believes while the Argentine government has a preference for the JF-17, it might be awaiting a better offer from the U.S. or Russia. My observation on this is that especially since the Falklands War, which I have a link to at Wikipedia so you can learn something about it if you don't remember it at all, the UK has had a grudge against Argentina since the Falklands War. This attempt at a fighter jet embargo by the UK is at least in part to prevent Argentina from trying again to attack and occupy the Falklands, which the Argentinians still call the Malvinas. From the US point of view, the idea of having a Western Hemisphere nation buying Pakistani Chinese military equipment is a non-starter. This is probably why the US is offering American jets to Argentina. I'm sure we'll discuss this more, but Andrew, your turn.
Well, you know, I'm leaning towards saying they should take the JF-17s. It's newer hardware, it's affordable, and it's out of reach of the UK, which has been a problem for them in the past. Considering also that the UK initially wanted to give the Falkland Islands to Argentina, I'm honestly not that bothered by the possibility that Argentina may try to take the islands again. I think if that does happen, I think the UK should accept Argentine rule over the Falklands and request permission from the Argentines to evacuate anybody who lives on those islands who wants to leave.
Isn't it interesting that we pronounce it both Argentines and Argentines? We just can't decide. One is American, one is British. But just saying. I think that, first of all, this thing with the Falklands / Malvinas actually goes back like 300 or 400 years, off and on. The British, the French, the Spanish, the indigenous peoples. At the time that the Europeans claimed it, there was no one living on the island. There's a treaty that gets involved that depends on who interprets it how. It belongs to Britain. It belongs to Argentina because it belonged to Spain first. It's all very, very, very complicated.
Yeah.
The reality on the ground right now is that the people that do live there, and there is a small population there, as well as now some British bases, they speak English. They are British descended. They don't want to be governed by Argentina. The war was undertaken by Argentina when it was governed by Juan Perón, who was kind of a fascist. You know, helped to shelter ex-Nazis from Germany after World War II. You know, Argentina was famous for that. When you talk about the weapon system itself, I think from a U.S. geopolitical perspective, and, you know, this is definitely sort of chauvinistic, but the United States, I think, is rightfully concerned, just as Russia would be if the situation was reversed, having a Chinese / Pakistani weapon system in the air force of a Western Hemisphere nation. Every nation considers that it has spheres of influence. To suddenly have a Chinese weapon system in Argentina could open the door to other countries in South America, Latin America, buying Russian and or Chinese weapon systems. that would be an erosion of U.S. influence, U.S. power, U.S. national security, for that matter. It also opens up the door to perhaps easier espionage of U.S. weapon systems by non-U.S. actors. Andrew?
Well, I think that those are certainly considerations of the situation, but I don't necessarily think that the U.S. sphere of influence should be considered the priority here, because I think
Not for Argentina.
Well, not for Argentina, exactly. And I think really this matters. This is a matter between Argentina and whoever Argentina is trying to, or whoever's trying to get Argentina to buy their, you know, military gear from. And yes, the U.S. is one of those, options. But
I mean, the United States is, at least from the article, the United States is making an offer as an arms seller, just as the Pakistanis are, just as the Chinese might be, or the Russians might be.
But what worries me is that the U.S. is doing this not out of, I don't know, a desire to see an ally well-armed and able to defend themselves, but, you know, out of trying to protect their own influence on other nations. And that doesn't sit right with me.
Well, there is the legitimate question of, do you want an arms race in South America? I mean, in Central America, there are small nations that don't have an army. They have just police forces. It's not that Latin America is demilitarized, but the militaries are mainly for internal security. They're not really offensively designed or offensively equipped. Now, Argentina, as the article makes clear, has an obsolete air force. And this is by design from the British point of view. So, I mean, they do need aircraft. They do need to be able to defend themselves. As a geopolitical matter, we don't want them arming to the point of being offensively capable, because that will start a Latin American arms race, which even from your point of view should be a bad thing. So, you know, it's easy to take one-dimensional views of these things, but really they are multidimensional if you take the time to see them that way. And yes, there's an Argentinian viewpoint, an American viewpoint, a Pakistani viewpoint, and all of them from their own points of view are legitimate. But the point remains, these are all multidimensional issues.
Interesting.
Okay, our last story is from CNBC.com. China will likely fail in its CPTPP bid, but it's a smart move against the U.S., says analysts. Now, Andrew and I had this discussion. Is this an acronym? And it's like, Andrew says, no, it's an initialism. So I learned a term. This, because you can't pronounce it, otherwise it would be like kip pup. So it's just an initialism and way too many initials. Anyway, the story goes, China will likely fail in its bid to join the Comprehensive and Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership, or CPTPP, but its move to submit an application highlighted the lack of U.S. economic policy in Asia-Pacific, said analysts. CPTPP is an 11-nation mega-trade pact formed in 2018 after Donald Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership a year earlier. Barack Obama had negotiated the TPP to deepen U.S. economic engagement in Asia-Pacific and counter China's growing influence in the region. All 11 signatories of the CPTPP must agree to China's request to join before it can be admitted as a member. Beijing's strained diplomatic relations with some member countries would hurt its chances, said analysts. China will also likely face difficulties in meeting the trade pact's demands for a level playing field in many aspects of the economy. China is not the only one that applied to join. The UK and Taiwan have done the same. Japan has an existing territorial dispute with China in the East China Sea. Australia has been receiving at the receiving end of import tariffs imposed by China. Meanwhile, Mexico and Canada could stand in China's way through the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA. The trade deal, YMCA, it's like a village people thing. The trade deal contains a poison pill provision requiring any of the three members to consult with others if it wishes to pursue a trade deal with a non-market country. In addition to political hurdles, China may have difficulties meeting CPTPP provisions that promote cross-border flows of labor and environmental protection, as well as restrictions on state-owned companies, said analysts. This is one of those things that is multidimensional. Right now, I'd say over the last 10 years, 15 years, there's been a rising tide against U.S. international trade agreements. There's been a feeling among many that it disadvantages the U.S. worker in order to enrich capitalists, which admittedly it does. A lot of industries have been offshored. We have learned as a nation how dependent we are on the supplies of other nations for even fundamental things like personal protective equipment, masks, gowns. So, you know, there's a place for international trade. There's a place for national self-sufficiency. But international trade agreements are about more than making money. They are also about interlinking countries and creating webs of interdependence, which, like the European Union, are designed both to create powerful national dynamics and also to keep peace. Andrew?
Well, this, I think, has been covered very well by you, Mike, and by the articles. And I will make one clarifying mention, though. The United States is not part of the CPTPP. We were part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is either a separate agreement or an earlier version of the same agreement.
Earlier but
the U.S.
version.
Okay. The U.S. is not one of the 11 countries in the CPTPP.
Correct. And Biden has made no move to make it one.
Right. I think that, you know, you've covered this very well. So the thing that got me about this article, the thing I wanted to discuss, was at the end of the article, at the end of the excerpt on the blog post at thinkwingradio.com, mentions a person at the think tank Center for Strategic and International Studies. Now, I decided, after reading the idea from someone on the internet, to start looking into the funding of think tanks whenever I see them quoted in articles. Unsurprisingly, the Center for Strategic and International Studies has major donors including Northrop Grumman, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Chevron, and BP. Now, I'm not saying that the center is being used to produce expert analysis that promotes American military expansion for the sake of their donors' profits, but I'm not saying that's not happening. So it's worth doing this research to figure out who's funding these think tanks.
It is true, and I agree with that. But also, to be fair, if it was being funded by governments, you could make the same criticism.
Sure.
If it was being funded by political parties, you could make the same criticism. If
sure.
it was being funded by individuals with enough resources to do that kind of funding. There really is no winning in this situation.
That's true.
But
some of them you're going to agree with more than you agree with others, so it's worth knowing what the biases are, much like when you listen to excellent political commentators like us. It's worth knowing what our biases are.
And there's nothing wrong with self-aggrandizing just a little bit. You know, you sort of double joint your arm and pat yourself on the back. Okay, you've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on 90.1 KPFT HD2, Houston's community station. My co-host, indispensable editor, assistant producer, patient person, and guy with a sense of humor is Andrew Ferguson. Thank you, Andrew. We hope you found the show interesting. We hope you've enjoyed it, and we hope you'll be with us next week. Y'all take care.
See you later.
Not too late, not while we're living. Let's put our hands out in time. There's got to be a morning after. We're moving closer to the shore. I know we'll be there by tomorrow.
You're tuned in to 90.1 FM KPFT, listener-sponsored non-commercial radio streaming at kpft.org. The election for the local station board is currently underway with 25 listener candidates. This is an announcement from one of them.
My name is Todd Walker. I'm a small business owner and attorney. My legal work has been primarily in the areas of corporate law and finance. I think I can apply both my business and legal experience to help KPFT attain the goals set out in its mission statement. KPFT allows listeners to enjoy local artists, explore issues that are particularly relevant to this area, and listen to points of view that aren't available in other media. We should all do our part to preserve and promote this unique asset.
To learn more about KPFT local station board candidates and to vote in this election, visit elections.pacifica.org. All ballots are due on Friday, October 15th. Make your voice heard.
Good afternoon, Houston. This is your forecast for KPFT. For the remainder of the afternoon, sunny with a high near 85. For your Saturday night, mostly clear with a low around 65. And for your Sunday, sunny with a high near 87. This is your forecast for KPFT. Have a great remainder of your afternoon, Houston.